This is Wade Rathke, and this is Wade's World. It's Friday. It's 9 to 9:30. We get to talk to some of the most interesting people in the world, and that's what Wade's World is about on KABF 88.3 FM, 100,000 watts of people power, www.kabf.org. Welcome. Glad to have you. And here today, we have Mara Leverett. Mara, how are you?
I'm glad to be here, Wade.
Well, it's a pleasure for us, and I think we got you here at the perfect time. So Mara is well known as an author and long-term journalist and activist here in Central Arkansas, as well as Eastern Arkansas. And West Memphis is something not everybody thinks about, but you've become an expert in the town of West Memphis and some of the things that have happened there over the last dozen or so years, haven't you?
Actually, Wade, it's going close to 20 years now.
Time flies, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. I didn't pay much attention to West Memphis until the year 1993, when three little boys, eight-year-old boys, were murdered there. And at the time, I think everybody in Arkansas, Mississippi, Tennessee were pretty horrified and concerned, because a month passed and nobody was found to arrest for these killings. But at exactly a month later, the police arrested three teenage boys, and it was within a matter of days, two or three days, that the Memphis Commercial Appeal ran a front page story saying that one of those boys had confessed and that the murders were occult related. And I had been reporting on criminal justice issues, crime, prisons, police here in Little Rock. But one of the things I'd learned was that though there had been a lot of talk in the years before that about occult killings and so forth, the FBI had done a big search for them and had not found any evidence that those were true and that it had actually been going on. So I was intrigued, and that's how I got started.
And you wrote a well-known book, Devil's Knot, about what you found, or I guess I should say didn't find.
Yes, I in 2002 my book about that, the resulting trials, came out. The three teenagers were convicted. One, Damien Eccles, was sentenced to death. The other two were sentenced to life in prison. And their ages at the time were 16, 17, and 18 years old. And what really concerned me was that, although I did not attend the trials, there were two trials, in reading and all the media I could find about it, I couldn't find what the persuasive evidence that the jury had had. So that's why I decided to go into in depth and look at it for a book, which I did. And at the trials, by a fluke, because the alleged motive of Satanism was so sensational, a small article had appeared in the New York Times about these three teenagers, three victims, Satanism, and a producer at HBO had called two very good documentary filmmakers and said, maybe you want to go down there and see what this is all about. They came down thinking they were going to make a documentary about three teenagers who killed three eight-year-old boys,
right?
Because they were all Satanists. And they, through a lot of hard work, got cameras into both of those courtrooms. The boy who allegedly confessed was tried first. He recanted. The other two never confessed. They were tried together on a second trial. The HBO cameras got into both of them, and a documentary film called Paradise Lost was made and released 3 years after the murders in 1996.
So that was actually before your book came out.
Yes, yes. I was working on my book. I was doing continuous reporting on this at the time. I had gone down and interviewed the men in prison, and I was keeping my hand in. But my book didn't come out until about 5 years after that film. But that film provoked kind of the same reaction in thousands of people that I had. Where was the evidence?
Yeah, where's the beef?
And yet their appeals went directly to the state Supreme Court, and unanimously, the state Supreme Court said no problem with anything that happened in any of those trials. It's all just fine and dandy. And that's where they were, and with no prospect of ever getting out. Except that this was the beginning of the internet era. A group of three people out in Hollywood saw the HBO film and said, we're going to start a website just for people who can't believe what they saw and want to know more. A young man in Denmark started another website just to acquire documents. There were chat rooms and all kinds of stuff going on, but this fellow in Denmark said, I'm just going to be an archive. No opinion, just an archive. And that still exists. He's still adding to it to this day.
Oh, mercy. And how many years would that have been for the Dane?
Oh, well, he's been at that probably for at least 15 years now.
That's some commitment there, too.
Yes. He was in high school when he got started on this. And so there was a fellow in Puerto Rico who started another website examining. He teaches, but he also was interested in forensic linguistics. And so he analyzed this so-called confession that this 17-year-old boy had given, and realized that he didn't say anything in this confession that had not first been suggested by the police. And so,
now, how did they get a copy of that confession?
It was immediately leaked to the Memphis paper within 48 hours of the arrest.
Likely by the police themselves.
Yes. Well, it had to be some official, police or prosecutors, somebody had to leak that.
So that inspired that original headline you were referring to earlier.
Well, yes, and then now we haven't even begun the trials, but everybody in the area is saying Satanism,
guilty,
satanic.
Crazy, and hide your children, right?
Yes, and so it was quite inflammatory, terrifically sensational. And so thousands of people around the world in the intervening years became interested, started sending money to get more investigators, more different lawyers, do appeals, and then...
But you were saying that the first appeals were rejected.
By the Arkansas Supreme Court,
and
unanimously.
Then what happened?
Unanimously in both cases. Well, then the last thing that essentially everybody gets to try in Arkansas is what in this state is called a Rule 37 petition, which is you get to say, my lawyers were not doing a good job. And they tried those. The Rule 37 petitions always go back to the same judge. And in this case, Judge David Burnett just routinely rejected everything. So they were blocked at the Supreme Court. They were blocked going back to the same judge. All of their state options were blocked. And because Damien Echols had the death sentence, people he automatically got legal help for his appeals. The others, life in prison, you're
screwed. Yeah.
But people were rallying around Damien's case in particular because of his sentence and because he's a very interesting and in many ways very charismatic person. And so ultimately some very wealthy movie stars, before that, musicians really jumped on to this, and they said, because part of the prosecutor's case was that these guys listened to heavy metal music and read books by the likes of Stephen King and Anne Rice and Dean Koontz. Damien Echols wore black, kind of goth before West Memphis had heard of goth, and all of it, the prosecutor pretty much summed them all up at his closing remarks to the jury and said, are any of those things of themselves evidence that these are killers? No.
Right.
He said, but if you put them all together and you look at Damien Echols, you see there is no soul there. And it, to me, that just smacked at the Inquisition. This was hearkening back to real primal kind of language.
Well, the next time you're going to round up everybody who ever listened to the Rolling Stones, "Sympathy for the Devil,"
exactly
of a certain generation, we'd all be in jail in that case.
And I see you're wearing black today, Wade. A very good-looking black shirt, but black.
And thank you, because the radio audience often doesn't get a good look at what I'm wearing. But luckily, you're a little brighter on a hot summer day. But so this is a pretty bleak story. But how do we finally get justice here, Mara?
We haven't. We have not gotten justice. Because people ended up, and I always want to give the musicians great credit. They said they were the first to jump in with big money, and Eddie Vedder in particular of Pearl Jam, Henry Rollins, they contributed greatly and spoke about it, and then others. The Johnny Depp got involved. Fran and Peter Jackson of the Hobbit films got involved with greater kinds of money than ordinary people had been able to get.
Unimaginable, but
because we're talking now millions of dollars for new DNA tests and literally millions and millions of dollars. In fact, Peter Jackson was quoted afterwards saying, "What's the price of justice in Arkansas? Millions of dollars." And then at the meantime, there are people around the United States and around the world who are sending $5 a week to try to help as well. Thousands of those people as well. So with a great amount of help, the new lawyers, new investigators, new forensic examinations, and because Arkansas had passed a new DNA testing law in 2001, they were able to go back and say, and all three of them said, "We want anything that you have retested." Jump forward, it was, and one of the items that was found was a hair inside one of the knots binding, the boys were bound with shoelaces, their own shoelaces. Inside one of the bindings was a hair, which was tested, and with all the certainty of DNA testing, was considered a match for the hair of one of the stepfathers of one of the victims.
And but none of the three young men who had been imprisoned.
There was nothing found at the crime scene that has ever been identified with any of them. And another hair that was found and identified in this second round of testing was found in a bark of a tree, and that was a hair of a man who had been with the stepfather and had provided his alibi for that night. So these are very disturbing facts. And about this...
And difficult coincidences.
Yes. At about this time, then, the lawyers for the three were saying, "We want to take this back into court and..."
Say that there's new evidence, I assume.
Yes, yes. And
by that time, your book was out.
My book had been out. Now we're into 2010. So okay. My book has been out
for a long time,
8 years. There had been two more HBO follow-up films about the case. And
Jackson, am I wrong? Didn't Jackson do some kind of a film himself?
And Jackson, the Jacksons produced a film themselves as well, trying to dig at this.
Right.
So four documentaries, my book and a book by the two reporters from the Memphis paper had been done. So there's been a lot of work on this. And,
a lot of attention
and,
for West Memphis.
And all the time, meanwhile, people are recanting their stories. They say, "I was under police pressure." The case is eroding. There was never one there to begin with. And what they had is eroding. So now the because of the DNA law, the lawyers are pushing to get back into a court. The Arkansas Supreme and the Arkansas Attorney General's office is fighting it, saying, "No, don't use the DNA law to allow this." And our Attorney General, Dustin McDaniel, was quoted at the time as saying, "We know there are no innocent. This law will never apply because Arkansas does not convict the innocent." Well, it's a sweeping and ridiculous statement. But they were fighting as hard as they could. Ultimately, in late 2010, the Arkansas Supreme Court said, "No, they get to go back and have a hearing to decide whether there will be a new trial." It goes now to a different judge, he appears to be leaning towards a new trial, and at that point, the new prosecutor in town, who didn't really have a dog in that hunt, basically decides, I don't want to be saddled with this old case I didn't have anything to do with. And they worked out what's called an Alford plea, which is...
time served or something like that?
Plea deals, you know, they're usually made before you go to court.
Yeah.
And instead of going to court. But now these guys have been in prison for 18 years already. And up comes a plea deal because the state did not want to go back into court with this. And they made a deal, which was, if you three men will say that you are guilty, even though you get to maintain that you're not, you plead guilty, maintain you're not, and that's the essence of an Alford plea. And if you'll do that, we'll let you go. We'll open up the doors of death row, we'll open up these life sentences, and we'll free you. And that's exactly what happened in August of 2011 in Jonesboro. They came into court in chains and cuffs, and they left in suits, walked out the front door, and Eddie Vedder was there, and two of them got into Eddie Vedder's big van with Eddie Vedder's security people and took off to
wherever the Pearl Jam was going.
Seattle. And one of them went back to his dad's house in Marion, Arkansas. And that's where it stands right now. They are all three convicted child killers and have those murder convictions on them. But they're free, which is a good thing. But my position is this is a disgraceful situation and the story's not over.
And I want to talk to you about what that really says about our legal system here in Arkansas. But before we do that, there's another movie coming out, isn't there? And this one, I think you were telling me, was based on your book.
Yes. Shortly after my book came out, a producer in Hollywood called me up and optioned it. And for 10 years, she has been working to get this film made. We have discussed it over and over again, and I like her vision of it. And she got an excellent, very fine director, well-regarded, Adam Egoyan of Canada, and to direct it. Colin Firth, who's won an Oscar, is one of the stars.
And
Reese Witherspoon.
Alabama girl.
Right. And she is the other lead star. But the rest of the cast is all very, very good. And the script is good. I've read the script, and I think it's going to be one heck of a...
And you're going to the opening in Toronto, I think you told me.
It premieres this weekend in Toronto, and as soon as the tickets went online, within 2 hours, both showings were sold out. So I think it's going to be
excellent. So it's premiering September 10th, and it'll be an 8th, is it?
Yes.
Well, that's very, very close by, and hopefully it'll be in Arkansas and down in this part of the country soon. I'm not sure it'll be showing in West Memphis anytime quickly, but it's bound to be here soon. This is Wade's World. We're talking to Mara Leverett, who wrote a famous book about the West Memphis case, and we've been going through the fact of this supposed satanic killing that turned out to have no evidence behind it. And what we wanted to talk about now on Wade's World with Mara is, what does this really say about the legal system, particularly the issues that I know have been central to you about transparency and accountability. What's up with that? I mean, what chance do we have?
I think the chance we have is going to start with accountability. And that backs up even further to transparency, Wade, that if we look at this case, everybody I know who's gotten involved with it, lawyers, the men themselves, and all of the people who turned into supporters, have said, if those cameras had not been in the courtroom, I could have written 12 books about the case, and they could have been great. But it would not have had the impact, the profound impact of the actual cameras. courts don't want cameras in there. We citizens are being photographed and filmed and listened to and bugged at every turn in our lives.
More than we imagined.
Yes, yes, far more than we, and probably more than we know yet.
Oh,
but,
absolutely.
But at the same time, a public forum, one of the branches of our government, makes it impossible for photographic images, in the most part. It's spotty. The federal courts, absolutely not. No way. No how. You can't even bring your cell phone into a federal courthouse. But some.
And if anything, it should probably be more common in federal court, I would think, because those tend to be very serious cases. But yeah,
yes. And say within the state of, within the states themselves, different states are doing different things. Within Arkansas, as in this case, it could happen. But this is how it had to happen. The judge had to approve. All the victims' families had to approve. All the men on trial had to approve. All their lawyers had to approve. All the prosecutors had to approve. They did.
In retrospect, that's an amazing thing in and of itself.
In retrospect, I know the judge has said he's really sorry he did. I've talked to other...
So much for justice.
And he prides himself on having a very open court. But I've talked to other judges. The best argument that they give for not wanting cameras, just recording every trial. Record the trials, and then instead of making somebody pay $800, $900 to have it transcribed into a written transcript, just have the DVD available for $5 a piece or whatever it takes, mm-hmm. and get it at the clerk's office. The judges I've talked to have said they don't want to. And why? Because they are afraid. They refer to the O.J. Simpson trial, where they believe that the judge and some of the lawyers involved were playing to the cameras, and that distorted justice in that case. And my feeling is it is up to the courts to make sure that the judges and the attorneys are not hams for the cameras, and that they do the work that they're being paid to do, which is to represent whichever side they're on and to officiate properly.
Well, that's also a preposterous argument, because it's the judges responsible for making sure that the jury was sequestered, and that would mean the jury wouldn't have seen whatever was on film. So at some level, who cares what was on film if the jury was a, well, I don't know. Would the jury have seen the film?
We want the jury to be, well, no, not to, the jury's going to see everything that happens in court, and we're just saying the only people who can, if you can get yourself down, if I could have gotten myself up to both of those trials, and everybody who was interested, we all gotten, as these are not big courtrooms, and people have lives, so it's kind of a throwback to Kill a Mockingbird, when the whole town can come in and watch Atticus Finch do his thing. That's not today.
But if it was ever anywhere,
yes.
Frankly. Yeah.
And we can't do it, but we can use this technology. You know, you can be searched before entering a courthouse and your body scanned and everything. We'll use all kinds of technology, but not this not have a camera just sitting there, just simply recording, not broadcasting, just recording. And it's opposed. So first of all, I say, we citizens, we can start demanding this. We don't pay attention to the justice system. We think that we have no impact, but we do.
And unfortunately, we only really pay attention to it when it intersects with us. And fortunately, most people, aside from some speeding tickets and this, that, and the other, don't have that much incidents there, except in some communities. Now, in our community, a community where we've worked for many years, the incidents is, I mean, look at what's happening in New York around stop and frisk being declared unconstitutional, and it's now a critical issue on who's going to be elected in mayor of that city, with the former mayor, the billionaire Bloomberg, saying stop and frisk no matter what, and everyone else saying, hey, you know, who are we really targeting there, even admitting that with reforms, it's going to be targeting African Americans, it's going to be targeting Latinos. In this case, though, I think these were three young white men.
Poor.
But poor, and West Memphis is a rough, I mean, it has been ever since I'm familiar with it. We used to organize there. It's a rough little town.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that you're going to be able to go and hire, you know, Perry Mason or whoever, you know, O.J.'s lawyer may rest in peace. That's not going to happen in West Memphis, Arkansas.
No, you had these were court-appointed lawyers with no experience in capital murder trials, and look at just take your run-of-the-mill drug case. I think a lot, far more people than we know. I mean, than we commonly recognize have got parents, a parent, a brother, a sister, a close relative who's been in and out of prison or is there now.
Absolutely.
Through these courts.
And, you know, I don't want to get from satanic and this injustice to the question of drug-based mandatory sentencing and those kinds of problems, but I had to be on a criminal jury last year, and, you know, we come up on a cycle every 3 or 4 years, so. And, you know, people would say, and I actually had two panels disavowed because almost everybody had some coincidence, and people could no longer believe the police on mandatory sentencing. So when a judge says he'll determine, no, that's not really true. And, you know, one little taste of something is the same as possession or distribution. I mean, the sentencing guidelines also, I mean, that's where it probably goes not to transparency but to accountability. The legal system hasn't caught up with the social system here, and it means we've criminalized vast numbers of people, Mara.
We can't hold them all in prison, and now we're beginning to realize that.
We're having to release them in Arkansas and so many other
places.
Absolutely. They're having problems getting rid of them there, but on another program, they're going to be 90,000. See, what's the exact number? No, 15,000 released in Texas this year that we're actually involved in making sure they know about the new health insurance plan as they come out. But, and that's Texas, where it's still lock them up, shoot them dead, whatever, but people don't have the room for this level of incarceration and don't have the money.
But people are very, very interested in court TV, wherever there's something that does show what's going on in court. The public is interested, and not made up phony shows, but where it's shown really, truly what's going on. And I think the disconnect is between the judicial system, the judges, the Supreme Court, all of these folks who, if you go, I've been to many of their conventions, the Bar Association conventions, where everybody's talking about people have to have confidence in our courts. It's fundamental to our democracy that we believe that we have honest and fair courts. But at the same time, we know polling is showing that that confidence is dwindling. And so if we're running such a good show over here in our courts, go ahead, put it on television, let everybody see, and then decide. We elect our judges and our prosecutors, but we can't see them in action, and they don't talk about what they do because they're supposed to like walk 2 feet off the ground, and so they can't ever even say anything about themselves. It's a crazy disconnect, and I think that what citizens can do is begin insisting that that bridge be gapped.
Well, and that's how appropriate we would be to make that demand. I think you told me that in addition to Devil's Knot, you're working on another book around the incidents of this case. Is that true, or do I remember correctly?
Actually, everything about this case seems to come in three. There were three victims, three accused, three HBO films, and I'm doing a trilogy. So yes, I'm writing my second book in cooperation with Jason Baldwin, who was 16 when he was put into the Arkansas Department of Correction as a triple child killer, and what those years were like for him.
Oh,
and
mercy.
It's quite something, and I hope
you can live through the writing. It should be a book worth seeing. And what was the name of the movie that's coming out based on Devil's Knot?
Devil's Knot.
Oh, well, that's nice if it has that same name.
Yes.
We've been fortunate today to be talking to Mara Leverett, who, as we mentioned, has a movie based on her book, Devil's Knot, that's coming out in Toronto any minute, and hopefully we'll be down here soon. This is Wade's World, though. Every Friday, we talk to the most interesting people here and around the world. We talk about the issues of the day and hear what they're talking about and working on. www.kbf.org, 88.3. You can catch the podcast on this later. Thank you. This is Wade's World.